what that.
Okay, Mac, we're back on, and she wanted me to get a little bit more official. We've got your name in there to start with. Today's date is October 25th, and it's just a little bit after lunch. And I'm going to say that I'm interviewing Mac McNeil. Oh, and well, this is the first part of the interview, and we're doing this in Kalispell at the McNeil House on, how do you say the name of your street?
Rufenach.
Rufenach. Do you understand what that means?
It's German for call after.
Call after, good. I knew you'd know that. And we're doing an oral history project, and we've got your name and the fact that you were born in Chicago, so we're kind of picking up from there. And you picked up the questions and looked at them, and you were right on the money. So can I get you to...
Can you introduce yourself?
Introduce yourself again.
Okay. I'm Edward McNeil, and I was brought up in Whiting, Indiana, the site of the world's largest oil refinery. There was all sorts of factories around. You could tell what direction the wind was by the smell. And I didn't realize till after I'd been through college, but we had a pretty good school system because the company paid so many taxes. I didn't realize before, but I was raised in an unfortunate fashion. All of the school systems, elementary, middle, and high school, so was in a sort of a two-block stretch, playground and everything. And just at the end of that was Carnegie Library. And we lived just across the street from that. And the result was I only went to school, came home, and didn't go home with other kids and so forth. And so I really had a restricted life because of where we stayed. Where I went to college?
Yes, please.
Oh, well, I went to Miami University in Ohio, and I was recruited into physics by the physics professor, and I graduated with cum laude with honors in physics. And that honors was one of the toughest things I ever seen. 9 hours of written exams and 3 hours of oral exam. So,
how many people were asking you questions on the oral exam?
One.
Just one. When did you first come to the North Fork? I know why. I think it was probably because of Cecily.
Because of allergies. While I was still in graduate school, I realized I had troubles about nose, summer flu, and so forth. And I'd been tested for this, that, and the other. And the guy said, well, the only thing I can figure out is it must be allergies. We tried going up northern Wisconsin, out on the peninsula in Lake Superior, but even that didn't get us away from the pollens. And so we tried coming out to Estes Park. What is that park? Has it more proper name?
It's in Colorado.
In Colorado, yeah. And found, lo and behold, no allergies while we were there. So Cecily started doing research to see if she could find some national forest land in the Rockies someplace where we could rent or something. And in the course of it, she saw an ad for land inside the national park. Charlie Green here had put that ad in. She jumped on a train and came out, looked at what he was showing. It was in Dutch Creek. The first place she saw she didn't like because there was rot in the logs. So the second one was very nice, and he didn't know if it was for sure for sale, but it was. And so she said, right then and there, we're going to buy it. And so from then on, every summer, we would come out to, at first, inside the park at Dutch Creek. And then, we began to, every weekend we'd visit with the various people in North Fork, because that time they had square dances at the McFarland, do they call it a ranch or what?
Dude Ranch is what it was called back then.
And sometimes in the hall, alternating back and forth. And so we saw a lot of people. I remember Adolph Apalka was the ranger at Polebridge at that time. And I remember early on sitting on a log during a meeting, and Adolph was telling me, he says, "Now, you don't want to go shooting a bear on your property because you'll have about a ton of rotting meat or something." He says, "What you want to do is gut wound them, so go off in the woods and die someplace else." And I realized afterwards he was giving us a permission, go ahead and shoot, whether anybody says you should or not. And I found another reason why was that they were actually dumping the bears they caught down in Dutch Creek at that time. And so they would turn up occasionally in our cabin. You'll find in the cookbook that Cecily has my recipe for what's called bear stew, but it was just because every time we cooked it, a bear would come sniffing around the cabin.
So it taste good?
Oh, yes,
this is
beef bourguignon.
Pardon?
The recipe was actually beef bourguignon.
And so you just switched bear for beef bourguignon?
Oh, yeah, we did that frequently.
What did it taste like?
Beef bourguignon?
No, the bear stew.
It wasn't bear stew. Oh. It was because of bears attending.
They were guests. Or they wanted to be guests.
I'd have to go out and throw a chunk of wood at them or something. Cecily would be out with the gun.
Oh, so you've never tasted bear meat?
No. And we lived at Dutch Creek in summers for a good many years. Can you remember, what was the year of the Huckleberry Fire? Not 66.
Could have been 69, but I'm guessing.
Well, whenever, that fire burned down very close to our cabin. But one of the guys from Dutch Creek was running a tractor, and he dug a fire break, which saved our cabin. But then the Hungry Hours News publicized the fact that that cabin had survived. And they had, before we got out there, a bunch of vandals came in from the, I don't know how many. They jumped up and down on a car we had outside, broke windows and so forth. They broke in the cabin. They stole a lot of things, like we had antique planes, wood planes, left over from the previous guy, fishing gear and so forth. And then they took a container of varnish and poured it all over the books in the bookcase. They tried to break up the refrigerator with an axe, but it only dented it. That was sort of depressing. The Edwards at the logging creek said, "You better buy some land on the other side before it gets too expensive." At that point, Cecily did another search going up and down the road, and when she came to that section just before Moose Creek, where you were going down the hill of Moose Creek, you can see between the trees all the way up to Canada. And she was so struck by that view. She asked, "Does anybody have any property?" And yes, it turned out Stone Street had a lot right there on Moose Creek. And so she went in, and when she saw that there was water besides the homestead cabin, she says, "We'll take it." After that, we were there every summer. Oh, I take that back. I was at Harvard one summer, but they were there. We would buy a bit of lumber down in Columbia Falls. They let us put it on the cuff so we could pay during the year. And I worked on building the first cabin, the treehouse of the August Moon. Then after that was more or less finished, there came the year of the floods that took out the bridges.
Okay, that would have been in 1964 was the big flood that flooded half a pole bridge. And
well, at Dutch Creek, it damaged the bridge, so they took out the old bridge and just left the creosote timbers lying on the ground there. And after about a year or so, I somehow managed to use the VW bus to drag one by one up to our land, and I was starting to build a garage next to the old cabin, and Cecily vetoed that. And this is what happens to me. I start get something built, and they says, I don't like it. So I took them and put them in a, used them to build a foundation for a little cabin next to them. So that is the one that's called Pinewood, I believe. And it's a little closer to the ground, the first cabin.
Did you know the original homesteader of your Moose Creek property? Did you?
No, they were dead.
Okay.
And they were, I think, called Ingham. And then Stone Street had bought from them and held on to it for a long time. They finally sold to us.
How many acres did you acquire?
What?
How many acres did you buy?
103 something. It's a sort of an L-shaped plot right against the meridian. And the lower end just barely crosses Moose Creek. At the time, the old timers told us, you sure got took. You paid $40 an acre for that land. And God knows what it costs nowadays.
Oh, yeah, quite a difference. So when you're up there in the summertime, how is your life different than it was in Chicago?
Well, you couldn't go to the store for the milk.
How often did you go to town?
We went about once a week and stocked up. We had to think of everything. And kids had to help us chop wood and so forth, so that they realized that if you wanted food on the table, you had to do something besides just turn a switch. And it was also sort of because they could see cows and so forth, that the milk didn't originate in a carton.
Where did you shop?
B&B.
B&B. Do you know what that stood for?
No.
Brown and Brown.
Huh.
And now it's gone through several iterations, and it's Smith's Grocery.
Yeah. So we go to Smith's. At least I do. I mean, I did.
So do you have any interesting stories about transportation? Your cars on the North Fork Road, was that a paved road?
The first thing I want to say is something about manners. Back in those days, you could be driving your car out. Of course, it was dirt road.
Right.
And a car would be approaching, you would see from a distance. Both of you making rooster plumes. But in those days, you both slowed down until you were going very slow when you passed and you waved, so that you didn't make so much dust on the other guy's face.
Mm-hmm.
And then you speed it up after that. I don't see that anymore. It looks to me like more Indianapolis Raceway or something. I can remember when I was building the cabin, it was a 4th of July or something, and we could hear the cars on the road down below. And we got real excited because we heard 6 cars in that day. And nowadays, it's more like 6 an hour.
So you've seen a lot of growth, or you heard a lot of growth.
Yes. And we've tried to fight it all the way.
Do you have any memories of road adventures with your various vehicles, your cars, your VW, and did you have a Nash also?
we didn't have the names on you, only the thing that you were asking something about.
Yeah, about, okay, before we start again. Okay, my question was, what are your memories of adventures on the road with your vehicles, with, did you run into trouble? Was the North Fork Road in...
The only thing is, every once in a while we get a flat tire. And then you just have to change it. Oh, and then you did have to worry about logging trucks. Sometimes there was a period when logging was going on up there. And we got one of these CB radios that in the VW. And so we tried to call out, we're at milepost so-and-so, to give a warning to the loggers, too. I don't know that it did much good. We didn't have any trouble. I know some people ran their car off the road, turned over, and said, well, there was a squirrel in the road or something. But I don't think anything very adventurous about the road.
Did you make a road trip to...
More adventurous things were right around the cabin with the animals, because we actually did see mountain lion a couple times. The funniest one was when we finally had boat cabins in, and the whole Christmas family was down to visit, and one of them was saying, I've always wanted to see a mountain lion. And at that time, I guess it probably was Bruce who was having, needed to have his diaper changed, and Cecily went into a cabin. He was squalling, and we looked up, and a mountain lion came around looking. Walked, remember, he could walk under the other cabin, and went right on past in front of six or eight people, audience, and they were amazed that when you bring up the topic, you get a show.
They didn't think it was planned, it just happened, huh?
Yeah. The other one, I was lying trying to sun with a dog next to me, and the dog got sort of fidgety, and I was wondering why. And I looked up, and I could see just going behind a bush nearby was a long piece of rope, yellow rope, about this high off the ground, moving along. And I said, whoops. What else could it be?
Did you instantly know that, or did you have to ponder on it?
I had to ponder a bit, because you know, at first it's a levitation effect, which is a little surprising, and then you try to work back to what it might be. You see, we've had people poaching there. Apparently, no trespassing signs don't mean a damn thing.
Do you think that could be because the people don't have a clue where they're at? They think they're on Forest Service land as opposed to...
No, these were North Forkers who knew damn well where they...
So one of the questions we ask everybody, and it may or may not affect you, but those were early days, but not necessarily homestead days. Did you have any different ways of communicating other than the CB radio?
Oh, the way we communicate is by voice. And so you could walk over to their place to talk to them, or you get in a car and go there. And that was the only thing you could do. Now, for a while we also had a radio, but that wasn't for talking to the local people. That was for, well, I remember that one evening I looked out and I saw a little light over Parkside, and so I called in a fire warning on it. And Joe Apalka was very happy because his fire truck paid off on that occasion. It was someplace where he could drive right into it and squirt it down.
Did you have any other wildfire experiences while you were on the North Fork?
The Red Meadow Fire was sort of west of us and coming towards us. And we didn't know if it was going to split and go north or go south, because as you watched, you could see the direction of the smoke cloud just changing all kinds of directions. And we were worried about Ruth Saunderson. We're pretty sure it was, we went down to see that she was all right, and she was busy packing away photographs and stuff into her truck. And I can remember the gossip going on while this was happening, and I was watching the smoke cloud up above, and when it finally started going straight overhead, I said, we've got to go. And we went away to Apgar. I hear that, let's see, the oldest Edwards boy, you? Well, what was the one that was in the Army?
Gary.
Gary, yeah.
The middle, the second boy.
I heard that Gary stayed through the whole damn thing. Well, he was lucky he didn't get burned out. That's all I can say.
Was this the 1988 fire?
Yes.
The Red Binge fire? The Red Binge fire.
Okay. Now, Huckleberry fire, for instance, the Forest Service were in that thing. It's now at the Institute or something. And they had seen the fire, and they called the park and said, do you want us to go across and spray that down? And the park said, no, no, that's our jurisdiction. And then they fiddled around for several hours, and by that time the fire had spread all over towards the mountain. But after that, they, and it may be partly because of the interlocal thing that we persuaded them to start, that they, some subsequent fires, that everybody cooperated.
Right.
But it took a while to learn, apparently.
Were you happy to see that interlocal committee start so you could figure out what was going on?
Well, we were the ones that were pushing for it. So, yes, I think, and I think experience shows it has helped. Because there wasn't much communication. The sort of things I remember some homesteader stories, you know, the Holcombs. Next to their little house, there was a big stump hollowed out inside, and that they had made for a smokehouse in the early days. And old man Holcomb told me, and then those days you could see mostly just big trees, no underbrush, with fair spacing between them. And to make his barn, I think he said, he cut down three trees to make the sides. He had a couple horses to help him put it together. And I remember, as long as she was alive, Ma Holcomb would get up in the morning and go down and fish for something for breakfast, and then make bread. And it was just surprising.
They pretty much lived off the land, I believe, or they?
Yeah.
And that's what you're kind of alluding to.
Oh, yes. You had to. Now, as I understand it, some of the other homesteaders, part of the family would stay in the North Fork, and another part would have to go work on the railroad in the summer to make money, because that's the only way they could survive. Can you remember the name of Ann Holcomb's brother? Ben Holcomb, was it?
I don't know. Do you know, Tom?
I don't know who that was. Ann Hansen, maybe, and Ben Hansen.
Yeah.
That Not Holcomb. I think that's a year.
Did I say Holcomb?
Yeah, she did.
Oh, that was it. I meant Henson.
Okay, I thought that's who you might have meant.
He was telling a story about when he was a kid up there, and they had horses, and he was, before breakfast, told to go out and do something with the horses, and he found no horses. And he looked over across the river, and there they were over in McFarland's meadow. And so he crossed the river, wandered over the horses and tried to sneak up and stop one of
them. Catch one.
And they all went to the other end of the meadow. So he trod down and finally got there and tried to sneak up and catch somebody. And they just turned back and went to the first end of the meadow. And this happened a couple times. And so one time it was down near the south end. And I think it was Black Jack Reuter that had a cabin there. And he came out and says, "You've been having some trouble, boy?" He says, "You must be hungry. Would you like some breakfast?" And he said, "Well, yes, sir." And so they went in this cabin where a little bed had been made into one corner and a table with a zinc top in another corner, and in the third corner there was a stove, and in the middle there was a sack or something with the dog lying on it. And Blackjack starts mixing up, he gets a bowl and he puts in, I guess it was some flour or something, and then says, "Now we need some yeast." And he said, he reached into this jug and he pulled out this big mess that was his sourdough and put it in. And he says, "Do you like oats in your cereal?" And he said, "Well, yes." And he went over and he kicked the dog and reached into that sack and he took a handful of that and put it in. And he then started cooking away, and he had to make the table look nice, because their tin dishes were nailed to the surface. And he took an old dirty dish rag and wiped them out, and that was doing the dishes.
So the plates were nailed to the surface of the table? Oh my.
And so then he served up pancakes, and he actually had good maple syrup to put on them. And the kid ate his bit and he says, "Well, now would you like some more?" And the kid, thinking about the dog, said, "No, sir, I'm full up." And so he went back and eventually managed to get the horses home.
What about Ralph Thayer? Did you know him also?
Oh, yes. He surveyed our property, and you remember the government did a catadioptric survey or something like that. They did something from satellites down to help them lay out, and they marked quarter section corners. And there's one, of course, on the corner of our land. And I went up and looked, and they had to pull out Ralph's peg to put their brass marker in there. And we were sort of proud of Ralph. Many years later, when he was in the old veterans home, we went to see him there because there was a sort of possible dispute about right-of-way on our land. And we saw that he said no, they didn't have one diagonally across our land. It was only a little strip at the very north edge that belonged to the National Forest, and they'd never taken an option on it. So eventually that cleared out. Once we came in, and at the bottom of the road where we're turning in, there were two guys camping, rather scruffy types. And we told them it was private property and that it shouldn't be camping there, but they didn't take that nicely. And so we called a ranger, I think it was, to go and talk. He persuaded them to go down to the Ford campground. And we later found out that they were convicts from the prison.
So you sized it up about right from the beginning?
Yeah. We treaded very carefully under those circumstances.
Did Ralph live in his homestead cabin while you and Cecily settled there on the
street? I've never been to his cabin, but yes, he sometimes lived up there. And I think... Who's the guy that moved and recently became?
In Thayer's cabin?
He sort of took it over.
The Hubbles bought it from Johnny Matheson?
I heard some of that stuff from a few of the people who were up at that end. But we were more likely to be thinking about the Saundersons. Who were the ones that were at the bottom of the hill?
Wirtz.
Wirtz, yes. Their cabin was stuffed with paper, I think it was. And then, of course, that later became the family with the German wife.
Lawrence.
What?
Barbara
Lawrence.
Yes. She would blow a whistle, and if the kids weren't in the car by the 5 minutes, she would drive off to town anyhow.
Good recollection. Did you ever spend any like Christmas holiday up to North Park? Were you always teaching and carrying on like that?
I never spent a Christmas holiday or anything like that. I was once in Kalispell during a Christmas season. That's after Alan had moved here. Mm-hmm. And that's when I fell down in the restaurant. Was something with a knee, which only got straightened out when I got back in Chicago. A guy got on the operating table and they did arthroscopy, and afterwards he says, well, it wasn't much wrong. I cleaned out some mice, but if you ever need a new knee, why, call me.
What a character. Did you attend picnics and square dances on the North Fork?
Oh, yes, regularly.
Tell us about them.
Well, mainly I remember we'd have to cook something, make a cake or something. I remember one in particular where there were comments about the icing, and I made it with sour whipped cream because that's all that was available. At the square dances, we did square dancing, and there was a fair collection of records there. And of course, you get to talking about the meetings. Oh my God.
The North Fork Land Improvement Association?
Yeah. I was president one year, and that was the year you probably helped work on the memorial privy in the backyard?
No, your boys got it. I got out of that for some reason.
Oh.
That was Morgan Hart and And Alan and Alan Chrisman, I think, were the ones that I've heard got volunteered for that job.
Yeah, they're good. So I know at least something worthwhile was done once. Another thing was important was the, in those days, the cabin was leaning. At least I put some propping poles up against the side that was leaning. And it was a year later or so that somebody took a tractor and helped pull it straight.
They pulled it straight is what they did?
Yeah.
This was Saunderson Hall?
Yes.
Yeah.
So was that year a good experience of being president? You must have known everybody then.
You can't really say that I know people because I have something in my brain that puts a shutter down whenever I'm trying to get somebody's name. And furthermore, in my college teaching, I would have 200 at least students every 8 weeks, and eventually you get snowed under. And I started out trying to memorize all the students when I was on Navy Pier, but the classes were a lot smaller then, too.
What was your experience with the land use plan? Tell us about what that was and what you remember about it.
Let me think. There was sort of fighting back and forth. I don't know, it was sort of like chickens pecking about whether to pave or not pave the road. That had gone on for years.
About what decade is this?
I don't know. It had been going on forever. And I think, well, I can't remember who else, but some of us suggested, why don't we get together and talk what we do want and see if there's anything we can agree on. And my mind is blanked again on the guy who wrote the column in the Hungry Horse News.
Larry Wilson?
Larry Wilson, yeah. I think he was very important in that too, because that's where we met. And I can remember sitting around the evening, and by then there were a lot of things we did agree on. It was just mainly the road. And so we tried to write up the stuff we agreed on. And I remember it came down to a final draft, and I was one, and
Harold, the Sweets?
The ones that, Sweets, Harold Sweet, and the two of us worked at that, and gave it back for approval, and then we submitted that to the county. And by damn, if the county didn't more or less approve it, because nothing like that had been done before, apparently. And after that, I noticed there were some attempts other places to do something similar. Well, that was something good and positive. But the moral is you got to keep fighting to keep it, because carpetbaggers come along. They don't know the minutes of the previous meeting, and they just decide we should do this. We'll build a Disneyland up the North Fork, or that sort of stuff. So it never gets to be a calm period about that.
So you had a fairly long association with the North Fork, from part-time to bigger part-time. What kind of changes could you capsulize, or did you see from the beginning to the end, or to now?
Well, I think I would say at the beginning it was much more like the pioneers here, much more neighborly. People would help each other, help them build their barn or whatever, or help them, I'm going to town, can I buy stuff for you? That sort of stuff. And gradually that sort of wore away. And I don't hear much about that anymore. What I hear is mainly through Alan now, because neither Cecily nor I feel too safe going up there anymore. I couldn't manage it at all. I'm sure she could, but she'd be worrying about being alone up in the property. So Alan has to take care of it now.
Does he spend quite a bit of time up there in recent times?
Yes, he's... There's not only the Landowners Improvement Association, there's...
The North Fork Preservation Association.
He's on the board of that.
And so
he has to keep going for meetings for that. So he's spent a lot of weekends up there.
Did you envision that when he was 5 years old?
No, not directly, no. But we did hope that they would be involved with it somehow. We originally took the property simply because we wanted to keep one square of land, more or less the way it always was. And you can't find much of that anymore.
A good thing. Thank you.
One more question.
Sure.
Did you know Bert and Thelmer Edwards?
Certainly.
Tom's parents? Tell us about that.
Well, now, were they logging originally?
Yes.
Okay, so from the beginning they were sort of our mentors. And they had an old park sign left that we picked up. And so that made us sort of the ranger for the Dutch Creek, for anybody that came along. But anyhow, we were always going back and forth between logging. Because the kids have somebody to play with. And I gather that went on quite a bit.
Yep.
I had one frightening episode, I'm sure it was logging. The family had said, oh, the swimming is marvelous now. And they persuaded me to go in. And I did get in and I...
Is this Logging Lake?
Creek.
Creek.
Right where it comes out in the river. My reaction was immediate. And I struggled, but I finally got to shore. I got on the ground, and hands and knees padding, and I turned purple on my legs and arms, like I always used to do. And that gave a scare to my wife, because she could see anaphylactic shock.
We're talking about glacier-fed water?
Yeah. They say, oh, it's warm now. The hell it was for me.
So could it have been hypothermia as well?
It happens very rapidly. I remember in Chicago at the Beach Grant Park out by the aquarium. Mm-hmm. I was there one summer and just for the sun, and the water is very shallow, way out. And I said, well, that must be warmed up pretty well. And so I started to wade out in. And I could feel itching starting on my legs already, so I turned around and came back. And it was probably a very funny sight because I had purple socks from here to the capillaries.
You mentioned earlier that you'd made a kind of a fancy cake for a picnic or a square dance or something. Did you do much cooking on the wood stove? I assume that that was
yes.
How you cooked.
Yeah. No, that was one other thing we wanted the kids to know, that there was a different kind of stove that was used. Now, I don't think they had seen my grandmother's house at that time. She had a Franklin stove for heating in the music parlor and fireplaces elsewhere. But I don't think they had seen that. But I thought they should see something of this nature. So we had a wood stove in the old cabin. Well, we had it at Dutch Creek, and then we had it at Moose Creek too in the homestead cabin. Mm-hmm. But when we put in the new cabin, it was a gas stove. It was a funny thing that in preparing for going to Dutch Creek the first time, I looked up, I'm trying to remember, the make, the refrigerator was gas burning.
Servel?
Servel, yeah. And see if they had something that was used where you had no service. And yes, they had a gasoline version. And I called them, asked about buying it, and they said, but that's for Borneo and Ceylon and so forth. And I said, well, but can't I buy one? And they said, if you promise not to demand repairs or anything, we'll let it go at that. So we did get it. That was the one that got chopped up in the vandalism.
Did you notice any difference between living in the park as opposed to living on the outside or in the Forest Service land?
I think yes, it was more social when we were out. Although, as you see, there was social going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of surprising by sort of wild woods and so forth, but these things were happening.
And there were more people on the North Fork than in the park. That probably made a difference too.
Yeah. Cicely made a cartoon. You've seen the book of cartoons?
Yes, yes.
The North Fork File?
Yeah. That sort of illustrated how it seemed to us. It shows some cowboy hat and jeans characters standing around being introduced to each other. And this is Dr. So-and-so from here. And this is Professor So-and-so from there. That's the way the title went. We had a theological enclave there with Funk and Hart.
Bob Funk and Ray Hart.
Mm-hmm. Cecily remembers going past in the car and seeing Hart swearing at his wife because the car was stuck and she wasn't able to get out of the rut. She thought that was very untheological. Another story was Rachel Sweet was talking about coming out to visit Hart. He was stark naked. Well, the way she tells it, he was sort of strutting out after her. Then later I heard from Hart, said he was in his cubby hole taking a shower and she barges right in there. And then she extrapolated from that.
He didn't take a towel out with him to his outside shower stall. And so we had to streak from the shower stall back to the cabin.
Two sides to every story.
And there was, in those days, there wasn't much traffic on the road. So he could normally streak without anybody
seeing him. Yeah, I told you about the six cars on the 4th of July.
Yeah. Well, should we take a break?
Sure. And they all said, yes. I said, well, I just happened to have some in the trunk. I had put it on dry ice and transport for several days just for that occasion. And I remember on another occasion making Grape Suzette.
On the North Fork?
I think that was still in a national park or something that's there. Oh, I did that in the North Fork, I'm sure.
Did you ever bake bread?
No, I did cakes, cookies, and so forth.
Gourmet pastry chef. And that was the reputation that is following you to this day.
Yeah. Except now with my wife governing my diet. My God, no salt. And very sparse, too. Of course, she's managed to get me to lose a lot of weight.
Do you feel better?
I can't say that. At the time I went to the hospital last, I was 255, and the last time I checked at the doctor, it was 220-something.
Oh, good job.
Oh. This cup has the transported from Star Trek. But it gets hot, the figures vanish.
Well, you can tell it's not hot at the moment. Mm-hmm. Footnote, this is Tom Edwards and Anna Marie Harrod and Mac McNeil, also known as Edward McNeil, doing brief interview for the North Fork History Project in October of 2011. End of footnote.